From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Colin Donovan. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
And we welcome you to Open Line Friday with America's favorite theologian, Colin Donovan. How are you today, Colin?
Pretty good, Tom. Pretty good.
Good to hear from you. We normally have Jack Williams with you, but Jack is off. Today is his birthday. How about that?
Oh, my goodness. Well, congratulations to him.
Absolutely.
We won't talk about how many centuries old that is or anything like that, of course.
Not me. Not me. I want to live to see tomorrow. We have some open lines. That's why we call it Open Line. 833-288-EWTN is our phone number. 833-288-3986. Now, if you're listening outside of North America, you will dial the U.S. country code and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And of course, you can always shoot us an email, the address openline@ewtn.com, openline@ewtn.com. Be sure you put Colin or Friday or theology in the subject line. So before we get to any questions, Colin, while we're getting some of these calls screened, I thought it would be a good time to talk about the upcoming election. You may have heard that there's an election, Colin. I don't think this is breaking news, but it is a big deal, and we get calls on just about all of our shows that want to know, you know, what is a Catholic to do to inform themselves? And I personally am very proud that we have such a wonderful, you know, voting resource on our website.
That's true. You can just go to our homepage, and there, right in your face, so to speak, on the navigation, you will see a voting guide. And you go there, you will find some articles which we in the theology department have pulled together. Not only statements of the magisterium, those are very important, but occasionally some of the issues that are going to come up and that we will face. And what we have said about, you know, what has been said about the important issues, you know, it's a truism that the church doesn't tell Catholics how to vote. That's certainly the case. And in the United States, where at least initially with Catholics immigrating from overseas in Europe and so on, you know, there was some concern, well, is the Pope going to come in and rule the United States with all these Catholics coming over? I think we've gotten beyond that, but it's still true that, no, the church doesn't tell us how to vote. That doesn't mean that there aren't moral principles that apply. There is a very long tradition, in fact. Obviously, in previous times, you would have a king or a queen, a prince or whatever, a little bit different form of government. But since the modern democracies, going back to the 1700s, doesn't mean that the morality has changed at all. And in fact, what we've tried to do in the voting guide is to lay out what the moral theology tradition is. Now, that's really quite important because I think a lot of times today, people, wherever they are on the political spectrum, say, well, you know, has the Pope really said anything infallibly about this or that or the other thing? And it sort of misunderstands how Catholic theology, Catholic teaching works. The magisterium makes pronouncements when necessary. For most of church history, there has simply been the tradition of the fathers and doctors of the church that has formed a moral theology tradition, which from time to time the popes have found necessary to reinforce certain points of the moral law. So in our time, abortion and euthanasia and some of the new bioethical issues and so on, they've had to make pronouncements of that, which amount to applications of that tradition. So that tradition exists, and what we've tried to do is put it in the moral guide that will enable people to see, well, what has the church considered to be important in voting, especially in the democratic centuries, of which we are in our third century as the American Republic.
Uh-huh.
What exactly, how should we think and what should we look for? How should we weigh the events? And in certain recent times, the Magisterium has made important pronouncements, certainly on abortions, everybody's aware of that, contraception, religious freedom. And those are not only in encyclicals and so on, but in things from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith to guide politicians and to guide others in these moral questions. And we point to those kinds of things. Statements of different people like Cardinal Ratzinger, who in 2004 as a cardinal and then as a pope in 2008 made some significant distinctions, which he didn't invent, but which are coming out of that moral theology tradition about the important issues, what's negotiable, you know, such as an issue like healthcare, where there can be 1,000 considerations, you know, how much should the government do? How much should private enterprise do? How much should be the individual's own responsibility? Or in the case of, you know, which kinds of things to pay for, what falls into basic care, what falls into emergency care, and how do we provide all of those things? So on something like that, a complex issue is a negotiable issue. On an issue like life, on marriage and family, in which there are natural and theological principles as well that apply, or religious freedom, which is necessary for people of conscience to know the truth and to exercise and live the truth, to exercise their religious freedom, as the First Amendment puts it. You know, it's important. Those issues depend, everything else depends upon those. If you don't have life, you don't need health care.
That's right.
You know, if you don't have marriage and family, your basic element of society is going to break down and it will be lead to greater chaos and disorder. Mm-hmm. You don't have religious freedom, you don't really, eventually, basically the government tells you what you're to do and not you telling the government what you believe and how you think it should act. And so these are basic to everything. So all of that is contained in our moral guide. All of that is contained with magisterial references on our website, with references to the bishops' conferences, a revised version of faithful citizenship, which mm-hmm. an earlier version, they revised it in 2019, and that is on our website. We've recently added an analysis of the platforms on the negotiable issues, at least, and that is how do each of the main parties stand up against these things about which there should be and cannot be any debate,
uh-huh.
because it's sinful to embrace them and to act in favor of them, and those things for which good people can disagree about because
sure.
it involves multiple considerations and so on, economic, political, practical, and whatnot. So we have all of that on there, and so we encourage people to get it. I might say, too, Tom, that we're airing now quite frequently on the network, the Theology Roundtable
yes.
that Doug Keck hosted with mm-hmm. Father Spitzer, Father Pacwa, and myself. That's a good resource that people have said, hey, this is great.
Yeah.
Something like that for people to see. And
yep.
anyway,
yeah,
there we are.
We'll be giving some more spins to that great program on the radio as we're leading up to Election Day. One thing that we do want to make clear, this is such a wonderful resource that we have, and there are others out there as well. But you're not going to see anything like, therefore, vote for this guy, or therefore, vote for this woman, because that's not what we do. You know, it is up to the voter, the person, to actually do that homework, find out where the candidates stand on each of the issues that resonate with you.
That's right. And I think there's a consideration we brought out on the voting, roundtable on voting,
mm-hmm.
and that is no one person in office affects change in government. We have, for good or bad, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, a two-party system.
Mm-hmm.
You're electing a party, and that has to be a consideration. You know, there's an important thing which the church has talked about in the United States, at least. It's not an expression used overseas as much, but a consistent ethic of life. how do we bring about a consistent ethic of life? And you have to ask yourself, not only which candidates will do that, but which party will do that.
Oh, yeah.
And this is an important consideration. So we all have to one day stand before God and say, I advanced the common good, which begins with the essential goods of life, marriage and family, and freedom. I either advanced those or I did not.
Okay.
And having advanced them, I made sure that our politicians applied them in the negotiable policy issues as well.
Very
because
good.
Because it's important that nothing ever fails against those essential points.
Amen. And the website, EWTN.com/vote, or you can go to the homepage and just look for that vote area. In a moment, we'll get to Carlene calling in from Fort Worth here on Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan on EWTN. Stay with us.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
I forgot to mention one of the other great resources you can check out as you're getting ready to make that poll decision is our very own National Catholic Register. It's America's most trusted Catholic news source with a comprehensive view of the world from a distinctly Catholic perspective. Give the Register or subscribe for yourself, or why not do both? Visit ncregister.com to get started. ncregister.com. Very proud to partner with the Register for all these many years. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. We begin with Carlene in Fort Worth, listening on YouTube, a first-time caller. Hey, Carlene, what's on your mind today?
Hi, yes, I've got a question about confession. We have a new priest, and he doesn't yet speak English. He's our only priest right now. And I understand from others who have gone to confession to him, he has like an English script for the absolution and to give you penance. But is that a valid confession, or should I try to find another parish and go to an English-speaking priest?
Well, you can use, just as a general matter, you know, sign language. You can, I don't know if you can convey which commandments you violated. It depends, of course, on whether it's the fifth, face-to-face or if there's a screen. So there are definitely some difficulties there. To be honest, I'd hesitate to rule on the validity of such a question. I would say it's putatively valid. In other words, the arguments are there. He's acting as a minister of Christ. You're confessing your sins. He may not be understanding them. He's detecting whether you seem sorrowful or not. He's making a judgment about your sorrow. So I would say that the parts are there. Is it ideal? Certainly not. Is it invalid? I don't think I'd go that far. Obviously, one hopes that he would very quickly acquire an adequate enough ability to appreciate and understand. I'm a little bit surprised that it's so basic and being assigned confession. So, but I wouldn't go so far as to say it's invalid.
Okay. Carlene, we do appreciate your call. Thank you so much for it. That opens up a line for you right now here on Open Line Friday, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Mario's watching us on YouTube right now, Colin. Mario says, what does transfiguration mean?
Well, this is a term that was used in the 60s as an effort to explain what takes place in the Eucharist. There were a number of the transfiguration, transignification.
Really?
All of these were intended to get away from the expression transubstantiation. And the reason being, well, you know, that old metaphysics, nobody understands it anymore. What exactly does it mean? And there is, you know, the effort, I'm not saying the effort was by itself heterodox, in other words, contrary to the doctrine of transubstantiation, mm-hmm. but be a way to express the Eucharist in a way which people could, that the finality of the purpose of the Eucharist is, of course, to unite us to Christ, unite us to God, to lead us to, you know, the end, the purpose, the finality, mm-hmm. the signification, what it signifies for. Now, and that being that it's the body and blood of Christ, just as our word sacrament refers to the sacramental sign, the signification. What does the sacramental sign mean? Both of those can be used within the context of the church's doctrine. But there's a significant difficulty, or questions were raised in the 60s with regard to the use of those terms alone, that Paul VI issued an apostolic letter on it, and it was called Mysterium Fidei, the mystery of the faith, just as we have in the Mass after the words of consecration, in which he said that no such use of those terms could be used of the Eucharist except in that context of what the church's doctrine is. And that is that the entire substance of the bread is changed into the substance of the body of Christ, and the entire substance of the wine mm-hmm. is changed into the blood of Christ. That's the starting point. You can say 1,000 other things regarding the mystery of the Eucharist. In fact, there's no end of things because it's a mystery. So you plunge the depths of that. And in that context, yes, you could talk about the finality of receiving the what is the goal here, the objective, the end, the finality that's being sought. You can talk about the significance. That's sort of in the sacramental area, the sign area. But to do that without referencing or without admitting the transubstantiation, mm-hmm. that would be contrary to the faith. And there were people doing that, and Paul VI was trying to put a stop to that, keep it in its tracks, and give it a proper lining with the doctrine of the Council of Trent and the doctrine of St. Thomas and those who came before, that this is truly the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ. And any lessening of that reality is a violation of that teaching and of the truth. And so that was the point.
Okay. Very good. And we do appreciate your question, Mario. Thank you so much for it. It's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan here on EWTN. If you have a question for Colin, anything along a theological line, do give us a call, 833-288-EWTN. It's a free call, 833-288-3986. Just got a text from John, Colin. John says, could Colin speak about the scandal with the priest in New Orleans and why the bishop had to burn the altar? Got a lot mm-hmm. of reportage on that over the last week or so.
Right. The scandal was that a priest who had been ordained for several years, so that would put him probably in his early 30s, mid-30s
okay.
or so, and this is not something, let's just do this, he must have been somehow involved with these two women who admit to being in some kind of a satanic group, and as part of that group, as part of their activity, the two of them got the priest to entice the priest in some way to have sexual acts on top of that altar. This, of course, defaces morally and otherwise the altar, a sacred object that represents Jesus Christ. You can see why Satan worshippers would do that.
Yeah.
You can't see how a priest would come to be involved with that kind of thing. But you can imagine, and nothing has been said about whether the Eucharist itself has ever been violated by this fellow. or given to those who would violate it. But this is not as uncommon as people think. When I was in the seminary, there was, on a Sunday afternoon when people came on the property to walk it as part of a Benedictine monastery, there was a group of people who came into the guest chapel, and they tried to rip the tabernacle off the altar. And it was, after the fact, it was assumed perhaps that they were with a coven of individuals, whether witchcraft or Satanists, who wanted the contents of the tabernacle, obviously. The largest, literally, the largest member of the community who worked the farm came into the chapel at that point. They did not get any further than that, and they fled.
Oh, that's good.
So God in his providence provided. But this is something that happens, because to deface, they cannot directly attack God. They cannot directly attack the incarnate word, but they attack him, and they attack the mother of the incarnate word through that which represents them on earth. That is through the sacraments, and in the Eucharist, they, of course, do directly attack Christ. So that's a prize to get a priest to provide them with the Eucharist, even more of a prize to get a priest to celebrate a Black Mass, a Mass which purposes the to profane the Eucharist, to profane the Mass itself even. And so that is an objective, and we have to realize this evil is out there, and we have to realize this evil is growing, and we need to pray for our priests more than ever before on all grounds. The sexual abuse scandal is a manifestation of it, because it's an assault among the most innocent among us, as is abortion. Abortion is an assault on the most innocent among us. And so this was the assault upon the sacred. The sacred is more, Christ is more innocent than any one of us, and even the most innocent child. And so this is the objective, and we see this growing. We see the attacks on statues. We see the attacks on churches. These are not direct assaults, but this is the best they can do unless they can get the Eucharist and profane it. So it's pray for your priests.
Absolutely, and I think it was a radical step for most people to hear that the bishop went to the extreme of burning the altar, but it was the right thing to do, wasn't it?
Right, because, well, if you think of what we do, we're encouraged to do by the church. If you have some holy object, you can bury it, or you can burn it. You can do something to destroy it. And because this act, of course, essentially removes the blessing, if you will. Now, the profanation removed the blessing, but this is a way of destroying it in its entire. It's a response to the act that was done. In other words, it's a fitting. It's a fitting reply to the act that was done. No priest shall ever use this altar again. No priest will be required to offer the holy sacrifice on this place made filthy by that activity. This is why it was done. And there are similar things in the Old Testament regarding how the priests behaved with regard to profane sacred objects as well.
Well, the only witchcraft I'm interested in is when Frank Sinatra sings witchcraft. We're going to just enjoy that, and that's it. And when we come back from our quick break, we'll talk with George in Maryland, Vanessa in Texas. Lots more on this edition of Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan. Stay with us.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
We have three lines screened and three ready for your call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Let's get to George right now in Maryland, listening on the EWTN app, a free download. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thank you for the opportunity. So I'm Catholic. So I just want to express my concern in these days. I hear a lot about more towards Republican support from our Catholic friends as well as EWTN. Mm-hmm. And my concern is we as a Catholic Church should not be siding with one or the other. Rather, we should have an educated conscience and let our people decide for what they think is right. So if we keep on siding on one side, more on the Republican, I really feel that we are driving a lot of people away from the church.
Well, we cannot support one party. We just can't do it. We can't support a party. We can't support a candidate. We can't do any kind of an endorsement for a number of reasons. Right, Colin?
Well, individuals can. There's no question about you or me or anybody in their off time making a political comment.
Well, sure.
Only if in the military do you get in trouble if you come out and do that. And priests actually as well are not supposed to do that if you're in an official office of sorts. But the idea that Catholics can't do it, certainly Catholic institutions don't do it, but it's not by virtue of any divine law or natural law. It's by virtue of federal law applying to nonprofits. Mm-hmm. However, here's what is plain. All the issues are not vanilla. Some issues are more important than others. And you get this crazy idea that Catholics have that it's simply this basket, and if one party has the basket that I like, I'm going to vote for them, or one candidate, and the other party doesn't. Then I'm going to vote for the basket I like. No, there are two strata, and maybe in that regard here, this would be useful here. I'm trying to find what Cardinal Ratzinger said. In 2006, speaking to the European Parliamentary Group in Geneva or Vienna, one of those places. Uh-huh. 30th of March 2006, and this is in the moral guide I referred to. Here's what then Pope Benedict said. As far as the Catholic Church is concerned, the principal focus of her interventions in the public arena is the protection and promotion of the dignity of the person, and she is thereby consciously drawing particular attention to principles which are not negotiable. So here he's talking about the church's official interventions in the public here. So the popes, the bishop conferences, they do analysis, they critique because they are moral authorities. Neither party says, well, we are the moral authority. Now that some of them speak very self-righteously at times, but that doesn't mean the moral authority.
Yeah.
So here Pope Benedict is saying that the church's interventions are geared to protecting and promoting of the dignity of the person. And I continue citing it. And she is thereby consciously drawing particular attention to principles which are not negotiable. Among these, the following emerge clearly today. So looking at the landscape but at the common and essential goods. Protection of life in all its stages from the first moment of conception until natural death. So Catholics should be asking, who is prepared to protect life in all its stages from the first moment of conception until natural death. Second thing he mentions, item B for him, recognition and promotion of the natural structure of the family and as a union between a man and a woman based on marriage, and its defense from attempts to make it juridically equivalent to radically different forms of union, which in reality harm it and contribute to its destabilization, obscuring its particular character and its irreplaceable social role. So the point I made earlier, that the basic cell of the society is marriage, a man and a woman, the children that come from it, obviously, common sense, the next generation. Human beings have two principal instincts, self-preservation and species preservation. We call the latter one reproduction. And so this is the second thing. The society depends upon it. The good of society depends on stable marriages. Common sense sociology demonstrates stable marriages produce children who are productive members of society. They've got the mother, they've got the father. For the large part, they have their free will. They can go off and become criminals and all of that. But it's certainly much better to come out of that situation, and it's better for society to come out. But it's not just about me as an individual or me as a man or a woman, but it's also about our society, the common good. And the third thing he mentions, his item C, is the protection of the right of parents to educate their children. In other words, parents are the ones given by God the authority over their children. We may not like how they raise them, but they will answer to God for it. It's not the state's job to step in and to tell them how to raise them. It's not the school's job to substitute for the parents and tell them what is moral and so on, what a family is and so on. So who in our culture, what candidates, what parties are promoting these three great values? So this distinction of non-negotiable goods is central to the mission of the Catholic Church. Now, as I also noted, these need then to be brought to bear on the policy issues. Healthcare, which respects these three non-negotiables, immigration laws, which respect these laws, when self-defense of the nation is necessary, that the dignity, human dignity, is protected as best as it can. Obviously, we don't blow up civilians. That's illegal in our country as well. Other nations, when they fought wars, they don't care. They blow up civilians. They blow up buildings, whatever. So all of these things bear on the other issues, but these three things are central. This is what the church is saying to people. Yes, they can vote the way they want. These are the principles which are central. Now, what is certainly clear is there is no politician and there is no party that gets all of those right. So it's the Catholic's job to infuse into the lives of these parties, into the life of our politics, these principles. And in that, they have a responsibility which is neither Republican or Democrat or Green or Solidarity or whatever it is. They have a responsibility as an individual before God to infuse these values into. So when the member of their party is saying, well, I'm all for abortion, I'm all for making hospitals perform abortions or same-sex surgeries or sterilizations or whatever, are they going to their party and saying, look, you know, I'm a Catholic, I voted for you guys, why are you doing this? How can you say you care for the immigrant, but you're ready to kill their babies and ship them off to the local abortion clinic when they arrive on our doorstep at the border? So are we infusing these values across the board? This is how we will get to a consistent ethic of life, which Cardinal Bernardin, who people often point to say that, well, it's a life issue and everything is a life issue. It is. You have to read what he actually said. He doesn't say that they're all equal issues. He said exactly what the bishops' conference says. He says exactly what the popes have said. And we have this on our website, by the way. We have in his own analysis of his own statement on consistent ethic of life in our library for anybody who wants to go. So, yes, the church is not saying vote for this guy or gal or him or her or whomever. But a Catholic who really informs their consciences, I think, in my own opinion, Colin Donovan, not Vice President of Theology, but Colin Donovan, thinks that the choices are clear in this and in most other elections, and they get clearer with every election. If that sounds like endorsing people, I suppose it does. But I think it's clear on the basis of the primacy of these three issues. And if there are defects in any party, I'm prepared to say to those parties, get with it. Treat the immigrants right. Treat the sick right. Do this. Do these things to the ethic of life. These values run through all of the policies, and it's not just about abortion, natural marriage, and freedom. Those are the essential ones. Without those, you're going to have a destroyed society.
Yep.
But you can't have the others and not those and not destroy society either. In fact, you'll more quickly destroy it by removing the three common goods, the three essential goods from that society. So understand what you're saying when you say we want its consistent values across the board, because also, how are you going to get there?
Sure. George, thank you so much for your call. We do appreciate it. It's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan here on EWTN. Want to let you know about a wonderful program you can check out tonight right here on EWTN Radio. That would be Father Spitzer's Universe with Doug Keck and Father Robert Spitzer. He'll be answering questions on reason, faith, suffering, virtue, and the existence of God. And here's a spoiler alert. He exists. Check it out tonight. Yes, check it out tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern right here on EWTN Radio. I got a question from Laura watching us on YouTube, Colin. Laura says, what happens when your spouse refuses to marry you in the church?
Sayonara? Catholics have an obligation, not necessarily to be married in the church building. That's a misnomer.
Okay.
But to be married with the approval of the church. And if your spouse is not, your future spouse is a non-Catholic, then, hey, you've got the leverage. That's all I can say.
Okay.
You can get the bishop. A bishop can let you get married in the Baptist church, in a synagogue, or where, you know, that's a dispensation.
Okay.
But to be done with that dispensation, that guarantees that the marriage is valid. Now, if you mean that a Catholic who is already civilly married, the spouse doesn't want to do the what's called the senatio of that marriage, in other words, to heal it, to make it right, to have it essentially corrected by the church, then I would say speak to your pastor. Some of those cases can be done simply with the authority of the bishops. Others cannot.
Okay.
So those are individual situations for people who are already married, want to get their marriage regularized, and aren't able to. Talk to someone at the diocese who knows what they're talking about and can tell you, and look at you and analyze your situation exactly, because that's what's needed.
Okay.
I can't answer a detailed question like that.
Laura, thank you so much for that question, though. Let's go now to Vanessa. Vanessa is in Richardson, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio, a first-time caller. Hi, Vanessa. What's on your mind today?
Oh, good afternoon. This is a question dealing with the Mass.
Mm-hmm.
What I understand and what I've been observing lately, as I watch different Masses from different parishes, here in the United States, I like to have an opportunity to hear different priests, see different priests celebrating the Mass,
mm-hmm.
and see beautiful churches, cathedrals.
Sure,
it's a wonderful experience. So what I see is there's a trend, and it seems like the Mass seems to be becoming more abbreviated than ever before. I always look forward to praying the Confiteor at the beginning. Now it's just this, basically, let us think of our sins and be sorry, and then just a slight pause, and then while we go into the Kyrie, that's one thing. Then when it's time for the creed, that seems to be completely now left out of the Mass, and I think
mm-hmm.
that's so important to affirm what our beliefs are, especially if children are listening. It's a wonderful lesson for them to hear. What do we believe in as Catholics?
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it depends on the context. With regard to the latter first, the creed is obliged on Sundays and solemnities. So if you're watching a Sunday Mass from this church or that church, or attending Sunday Mass, obviously, then there's supposed to be a creed. In Lent and Easter season, in the United States, the the Apostles' Creed can be substituted for the Nicene Creed. Mm-hmm. So there is that possibility. But both of them are creeds. And precisely as Vanessa, as you stated, we need to affirm our faith. We're there not because, you know, Catholics have the best after-church donuts or or whatever, you know, whatever human motive we have because, oh, they're all great fun. No, we're there because it's Christ's church, it's Christ's sacrifice, and the church has set out what must be said and done.
But if it's a Tuesday Mass or a Wednesday Mass that she's watching on TV, not necessary, correct?
If it's a solemnity, it would be necessary.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, seems to me, I'm trying to remember what recent solemnities we have, but let's say the Immaculate Conception falls on a Thursday. Mm-hmm. There would be in the United States, it's a solemnity for us. In fact, it is around the world. There would be a creed there. So any day which is a solemnity or a Sunday being sort of the natural solemnity as a little Easter, there has to be a creed. And as I said, it could be the Apostles' Creed at certain times. On the other elements, there are three options for the penitential rite. Sure, sometimes it's disconcerting if the priest takes only the fastest options, you know, the quickest penitential rite, you know, the second Eucharistic prayer and zip zap and it's over. I mean, it is Sunday. I think the Lord deserves better than that, but sometimes that's done and there can be reasons for it. Maybe he's not feeling well and boy, I better get this over and I hope I don't collapse on the altar or something.
Boy.
You know, so I think if you're in the parish, certainly, I don't know if you're just watching on TV somebody's parish, you need to intervene at all. But, you know, if you're in the parish and you're wondering why it's always the shortest forms, ask them.
Yeah.
That's all I can say,
sure.
You know.
Okay. All right. Very good. Vanessa, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Chris now in Nebraska listening on The Great Spirit Catholic Radio. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I would like to ask a question. How could a friend, a person, pardon me, go to confession? How would a person go to confession if they're... I'm sorry.
Actually, I'm going to jump in because we have kind of a poor connection, Chris. The question that she posed to our screener was, how can one go to confession if it's been a long time and you don't feel like you have sinned? I believe that's the question.
Yeah. Well, it starts is, and it may be, you know, a lot of people with poor formation, they don't understand and appreciate that at least materially, in other words, the act itself was sinful that they did. You look at the sexual arena and people growing up today or in my generation even, you know, and so they treated that casually and they maybe had no deeper sense of the seriousness of it than that. So there may not be moral culpability there, but the way to get at that is to make a good examination of conscience, whether it's with a booklet, and there are Catholic booklets that do that, in the lay missals, the little handbooks that Catholics use, also in pamphlets that can be obtained. Often parishes in the back of the parish in a pamphlet rack will have something like that to help you go to confession. And to sit down and examine yourself, because the question is this: I did something in the past, did I know it was wrong, and yet I did it? That's a sin. Did I do something in the past and I wasn't, you know, I didn't understand, I didn't have a good formation, education regarding these matters, I didn't really know it was sinful, then that wasn't a sin. But if to go to confession is to get also the more benefits than simply having the sins that we do absolved, but also to get the grace of the sacrament and the strength that comes with it, to unburden oneself of anything that maybe we're sort of tucking away, saying, if I don't look too closely at that, you know, I don't have to confess it. Well, if you know it's there, God knows it's there.
Sure.
Get it out. Get your conscience free. So I would say get such a little booklet or even the, just the Ten Commandments out of the scripture, Exodus or Deuteronomy, sit down with that and go over each of those and think, have I ever deliberately sinned against these? And if you don't think you do, then go to confession and say that and maybe say something that you have find to be your big area of fault.
Uh-huh.
You know, I gossip a lot, or I waste time that I could be doing something productive with the family or work or whatever. We all have faults that we can confess that we ought to overcome, and this grace of the sacrament can help us with that.
Okay.
So make that good examination and then bring something to confession, because confession has value even for the person who does not think or actually did not commit mortal sins.
Okay.
So just do it.
There you go. Chris, thank you so much for your call. We do appreciate hearing from you today in Nebraska. Let's go quickly to Mark in Cleveland, listening on Sirius XM channel 130. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hi.
Hey, Mark, go ahead.
I'm a revert to the faith. I've been for about the last 5 or 6 years, and I've been reading a book that was recommended to me by my priest, and it was Against Heresy by Irenaeus. And I'm about a third of the way through, and I'm struggling with, like, a theme of the book, and I'm just having problems finishing. Is there something I should be thinking about when I'm reading that book?
Well, every book has a historical context. So he was writing against what was the contradictions against the faith. I remember in the early church, the faith was very simply expressed. You had the baptismal creeds, for example. In Rome, what we call the Apostles' Creed was probably the creed that used in Rome itself as a baptismal creed, what the person professed when they came into the church to say, you know, well, what is it you believe? I believe in God, the Father Almighty. So you see here already the seeds of every other doctrine that comes down through history by the reflection and contemplation of the teachings of Christ and the apostles. So that's the context. And I think if you look at it, and you see the flowering of the early heresies. Human beings, sometimes they don't think enough, and sometimes they think too much. And so when thinking too much can get you into as much trouble, if not more, than thinking too little. And so not everybody is a simple sheep who says to the Lord, yes, here I am, Lord, what do I do? And then they go off. We start thinking about it, and, well, you know, I wonder if it really he didn't become man so much as he took a body and he appeared, you know, or if he had a beginning. And so these questions come up, and the early individuals like Irenaeus and so on. You know, that's sort of in that end of the second century time frame, or, yeah, end of the second century, the 100s.
Uh-huh.
And so he's dealing with some of the early controversies about the Christian faith. But already there was the creeds, and to depart from the creed was to depart from the faith, and so he's opposing it. Maybe thinking of that in that simple terms, that Apostles' Creed, that Roman sacramental creed, thinking of that, how does what he's talking about and the errors that he's opposing fit into that early church context? And the remarkable thing is people like John Henry Newman and others who sort of didn't oppose the faith, but they wanted to have a controversy with the church, and that is, am I not as Catholic today as the early Christians? They find out that there's a linear connection between the faith of Christ and the apostles, or what Christ and the apostles taught, and the faith of that second earliest post-apostolic century and all what the church teaches today. It's a straight line led by the Holy Spirit leading us to all truth. as our Lord promised.
All right, there you go. Mark, thank you so much for your question. Glad that you're listening to us today. Wow, Colin got through a whole bunch of questions, phone calls, emails, texts. We covered the waterfront here. Thank you so much, my friend. I hope you have a wonderful weekend.
You too.
And thank you. We have hopefully a wonderful weekend for everybody listening. Don't forget about the wonderful resource that Colin mentioned, EWTN.com/vote. Everything you need to know to make that informed choice as you're heading to the polls. And of course, keep listening to EWTN radio, television, internet. We will get you covered as well. On behalf of our great crew here, I'm Tom Price. Thank you so much and have a wonderful weekend. Be sure to stick around for Open Line Monday with John Martinoni, and we'll see you then.